This is the Alternative Investing Advantage podcast from Advanta IRA, where we show you how to explore investments beyond Wall Street and open your eyes to new options for your portfolio. It's time to take control and give yourself the freedom to choose where you invest your money.
Hi, and welcome to another edition of the Alternative Investing Advantage podcast. My name is Alex Perney, and today we are very pleased to welcome on Heather Dreeves with Secured Investment Corp, the director of funding for that organization. And we're going to be digging into a topic that I really enjoy from the perspective of what we do for retirement plans, and that's investing into real estate debt. You know, a lot of people focus on the benefits of doing the equity side of things, and while owning property certainly is a attractive option for a lot of people, when it comes to looking at, you know, alternative ways of investing in real estate, debt offers a lot of benefits that people might not necessarily be aware of, and we'll certainly dig into those today. So Heather, again, thank you very much for being on with us today. If you wouldn't mind, give us a little bit of background about yourself and how you came to be at the firm and position you're currently in, and then we'll dig into the topic at hand.
So thanks for having me, Alex. I appreciate the opportunity. A little bit about myself. I have been in the fund management private money space for 19 years. I came on board with Secured Investment Corp 11 years ago, actually about 11 and a half years ago. And, you know, kind of started from the ground up, did everything from originating my own private money notes up through escrowing and servicing that kind of paper, as well as underwriting, and then ultimately ended up really having a passion for investor relations and working with clients that were trying to, you know, create wealth through vehicles like self-directed accounts, as well as personal funds. You know, some of them were trying to accomplish cash flow, as well as more of a growth-minded model as far as an investment strategy. And, you know, really have stayed in that space, you know, very actively for the last 15 years. And we're big believers in self-directed accounts. You know, I think we're all of the opinion we want to create wealth and cash flow in tax deferred and tax sheltered environments. And so we work with probably, I'd say 90% of our database is using some kind of a self-directed account. So I currently manage our investor relations. I work hands-on with the clients that are looking to passively invest. And I have a team under me that does that as well. And then also I manage the day-to-day activities of the fund and help make decisions with the other fund managers as far as what we're going to invest those dollars in.
So, okay. Yeah. Sounds great. So let's kind of start at the beginning of looking at, you know, the points that you like to focus on when it comes to debt. So when, you know, from your perspective, what areas of debt do you like? Do you like the origination side? Do you do like secondary market purchasing, performing, non-performing? What's kind of the investment thesis of, you know, I mean, obviously Secured Investment Corp as a whole, but to the point of like, you know, what is kind of your main area of expertise and what you've seen people have success with?
Sure. Yeah, when it comes to debt, there's a million ways you can do it, right? and what we focus mainly on is we originate our own debt. And so really what our niche is private lending. So we lend money to other real estate investors. So hypothetically, your real estate investor that wants to go buy a distressed property, wants to rehab the property, add value to it, and exit a loan by either refinancing or selling a property, that's what we do. We're a bridge lender. So we're going to fill in that gap for these active real estate investors that are looking for funding for their projects, right? Some of them are exiting our loans by refinancing them into more favorable terms. And an example of that would be the guy that's going to buy a distressed property. He's going to rehab it. He's going to get a tenant in it and cash flow. He's going to exit our loan with more favorable terms, maybe like a 30-year rental product. Or some of our clients are using the BRRRR or the fix and flip method, right? They're buying it distressed, increasing the value of it by rehabbing it, and then they're selling it. But ultimately, everything that we do is short-term in nature. So the debt that we create is our own debt. We're not buying other people's paper. We're not in the non-performing asset space. But we are originating short-term paper. Our average loan term is 12 months. And we're not lending borrowers more than 70% of the value. So there's a very large equity play in these deals, which when you're in the private money space and you're talking about debt, the key is you know, do you have enough equity in this deal that if you ever have to take it back, you're going to get out whole and make some money? And so we really believe that that 70% maximum loan to value is where we want to be. And even under that, I mean, there are a lot of areas that we don't lend more than 50% of the value.
Okay. Now let's, so with regard to the short term, is 12 kind of the bottom end? Or I know when people talk short term, it's only 12 to 18 months. Mm-hmm. So what's kind of the window on, you know, with the bridge debt side of things that you find is kind of the sweet spot for that?
So we're seeing an average payoff as far as terms go at about 10 months. You know, some go to that 12 month window or their maturity date. And then there's a handful of other ones that pay them off sooner. You know, what we want to do is be lending money to our active, successful real estate investors that are getting in and out of these deals. These are not low interest loans. You know, there is a cost to doing business with us, but our sophisticated borrowers just work into their numbers. So the quicker that they can get out of those deals, the more money that they make. But average loan term goes about 10 months in nature.
Okay. And these are all going to be non-owner occupied stuff. So you're not having to deal with things like Dodd-Frank and the origination compliance for that. It's all going to be like investor loans, correct?
Yeah. We call them business purpose loans. So we only lend to entities. We don't lend to individuals. And that eliminates concerns with Dodd-Frank and lending laws. Always non-owner occupied. And the other big key is we only lend in a first lien position.
Okay. Now, from the perspective of the underlying asset, are these only going to be like non-commercial, so three or less conjoined units type thing, or do you get into the commercial side at all?
We do not lend on commercial. So we'll do single family residential up to four units.
So oh, yeah. Yeah. So four or less conjoined units is commercial. I always get that number confused. So, excuse me. So again, the perspective, we've kind of, you know, identified, again, the general focus of, you know, real estate notes that you're kind of interested in. It definitely makes sense. Now, we'll get into maybe some of the more nuanced structures of how these things can kind of be packaged into an investment vehicle. But one thing I'm always curious to know is that when you are doing this, is the play kind of from the perspective of going, okay, well, you know, it's great that someone borrows the money, but you know, loans make their money over the course of them repaying. You know, if someone borrows one day and then they flip it in the next month, how do you kind of hedge against that? Is it just a volume of loans out there to where it kind of aggregates to where, you know, if someone pays off in a month, well, the other person's paying off at 10. So you do to average it out, or is there stuff built into the way that y'all like to do things with, let's say, prepayment penalties or upfront points that kind of helps to mitigate that risk to investors?
Yeah. So, to answer a couple of those points, one, we don't charge prepayment penalties, you know, and I know that is something out there that private lenders sometimes do. Our opinion on that is I don't want to penalize Alex for paying us off early. What I want Alex to do is pay us off and come back to us when he needs funding for another project, right? So we've created this ecosystem of borrowers that continually come back to us. So we don't charge prepayment penalties. However, we do charge origination points up front. So you do, you know, the fund benefits are our real estate funds that we manage, which is how we originate all these. They benefit because we do charge upfront points. And then our borrowers make interest-only payments every month. And we have such a flow of deals. And actually, recently, with banks tightening up, it's become even busier. The other thing is we culture relationships with brokers. So it is impossible for us to have an outreach in every area across the United States, right? So we have relationships with brokers that bring us a lot of deal flow. You know, they know our system, they know what we require, and, you know, providing that their borrower can provide all those items, they can get deals moved through pretty quickly. And our really successful borrowers, they just turn and burn. I mean, they have a lot of borrowers that are repeat clients of theirs. And so I think that's another way that, you know, we're hedging that we have enough deal flow, because you're right. Some of those borrowers pay off early, you know, and that's, you know, part of one of the risks is you might have to redeploy your capital. But if you have a pipeline of enough deals and brokers bringing you deals, you know, that's how you keep that money deployed out there all the time.
Yeah, and that's definitely one of the, you know, the aspects of, you know, of the benefit of investing into a larger, you know, kind of aggregated fund, if you will. You know, I've been doing this for about just the alternative stuff for about 12 years now. And, you know, one of the biggest gripes I would get from my debt clients is that, you know, someone, and I always thought it was strange when I was really, really young, and well, I guess I'm still pretty young, but when I was first starting my career, was that, you know, someone lent someone 200 grand and then, you know, 2 weeks later they get a wire back and they're like, ah, the person's paying me off. And I'm like, this doesn't make any sense. Like, why are you mad? Like, I want someone to pay me back immediately. But, you know, again, from the debt side, you know, it's good to have them pay because how you make your money. Now, as far as kind of deals, and I'm always interested in current economic events, is that with the, you know, shift in the Fed and the monetary policy, rising interest rates, the velocity of money decreasing on the institutional side, do you see that as a good drive for your business with the institution? Well, I should say the larger institution, you're an institution yourself, but the larger institutions getting, you know, kind of pulling back from lending money or being much more restrictive. Does that open up more markets for you?
I think it absolutely does. And we've seen that just in the last few weeks. We've seen an influx of submissions. I think as a lender, one of the things you have to be mindful of and very cautious in this type of an environment when there is a lot of restriction on, you know, more traditional resources for funding, is you also see an uptick in fraud, you know, because people are desperate, right? They can't go to their bank. Banks aren't giving money like they were a year ago or even 6 months ago. And so that's something that, you know, as an organization, we look at really closely is like, yeah, it's good for us. We're going to see a bigger, you know, concentration of submissions, but we also have to be mindful that you're going to also see an uptick in fraud and things of that nature. And then the flip side of that also is, how do our borrowers exit our loans? You know, if they were relying on refinancing as a exit strategy or even selling it for that matter, what does their market look like? You know, as interest rates rise, property sales have cooled off. We still think it's a really good time to buy because people are going to be able to buy at a lower purchase price than they would have 12 months ago, but not everybody sees it that way, right? People aren't selling their houses to upgrade because they're not going to get rid of their 3% mortgage that they got 2 years ago to trade it for a house that costs more money and they're going to pay 7.5% on. So it's a balancing act. I think it's good for private lenders and debt funds like us, but I think it's also important to be good stewards of our fund and our investors' money and proceed with caution, right? Yes, there's opportunity, but you know, with opportunity also sometimes comes other risks.
Yeah, that's a good point. And there's a second question I want to follow up to that. But to the point of, you know, yes, the restrictions, you know, the monetary restrictions and everything that we're seeing, just because there's more deal flow doesn't necessarily mean it's good deal flow.
Right.
You know, the people that are coming out that were relying on something, you know, if they're relying on that 30 year with the 30 years are drying up and they're coming to alternative finance, then, you know, where does that kind of play into the thing, to the whole spectrum of it? So while I guess what you're kind of saying, while it's good, it's also bad. And it's, you know, kind of the yin and the yang are rising at the same time of saying, okay, well, this is good, but it's also not so great because you're getting more, but you're also getting more of the bad stuff as well. And then you mentioned fraud. Now, that's something I'm kind of interested in just you elaborating on a little bit more. When you say increases in fraud from your perspective, I know what fraud means from mine in general, but yeah, from the loan fraud side of things, what exactly does that mean? And investors need to be aware of what's going on out there right now.
Well, I think, you know, if people are out there trying to create their own debt deals, you know, one of the things that you see an increase in this type of a market environment is a lot of people trying to get financing on owner-occupied properties is mm-hmm. one of them, you know, because they can't go to their traditional resources like they could have. And so, you know, what that means is these are people that are living in the properties. And we, and you already mentioned this, we don't lend on owner-occupied. We don't want to. We don't want to have to deal with the licensing for that. There's just a lot of red tape with that. And the reality is, if you ever have to foreclose on an owner-occupied property, it's very difficult. And so we choose just not to play in that space. So I think that's one of the biggest things that we start to see is people trying to, you know, get a business purpose loan only loan, and we find out that they're living in it. And you'll find that you'll see fraudulent bank statements, fraudulent tax returns, you know, things like that, which are requirements that we require because we want to see that they have the finances to service the debt and be successful in paying us off and rehabbing a house, as well as we want to see that they're actually filing their tax returns. You know, we see a little bit of that. And then, you know, one that I think you always see is a seller and a potential buyer per se that are in cahoots, and they're trying to get a big cash out refinance on a loan, you know, and they're going to split the profits, and then we just bought that property. And that's something that's always been there, you know, and that's, you know, it's basically not an arm's length transaction is what it is.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's definitely a lot more common. But the aspect of people trying to, again, pass off, you know, them actually living in the property, how do you even find something like that? It's definitely not necessarily something that always pops up in a title search.
Well, they're not very smart about it. You know, little things like we'll catch a bank statement with the property address on it. You know, it's like, yeah. Oh, well, that's my rental, and I just send my bank statements there. It's like, who does that? You know,
you want your tenants having your bank statement?
Yeah, we've even seen pictures on the wall of the property in an appraisal with our borrower in a framed picture. I mean, as crazy as that sounds, you know, but mostly it's like addresses, you know, hey, at one time live at this house. And when you pull their credit report, you can also see their past residences, you know, and their addresses. So little things like that, you know. Usually people that are trying to pass fraud aren't that smart about it, to be honest with you.
Thankfully, criminals tend to overlook things. I'll say that. At least that plays in your favor, but it's still something to be aware of. And that's, you know, with any marketplace, you know, whether it be wire fraud or loan app fraud, there's, the problem is that when the economy gets tough, that all that kind of stuff rises right along. It's a direct correlation. So it's, definitely something to watch out for. So let's kind of, again, get back to the topic at hand of debt and, again, why things are beneficial. Now, let's get into a little bit about how, you know, you like to go about structuring these things. Because, you know, it's easy enough, I think, for someone to understand the benefit of lending someone money. You know, someone needs to borrow money, you lend it to them at 18%, 100 grand goes out, you get, you know, $118,000 back on your money or whatever the loan payoff happens to be when they pay it off. So I think it's easy for people to kind of understand, okay, you have a note that's packaged in. But when it gets into investing in these as a more passive investor, and granted, I know people out there listening are going to say, well, loans are always passive. You just send them the money and they send it back to you.
Yeah.
But from the perspective of you're not going out there, boots on the ground, originating this, meeting with the borrower, you're kind of, again, turning it over to a steward, you know, someone like yourself to do it. So, you know, walk us through the process of kind of the investment thesis of why you structure things the way you do and what some of the benefits and drawbacks to doing the different methods that you have going on are.
Well, I think it helps to understand where we started from. 11 years ago, we did not have what we call real estate funds to actually invest in. We just sold notes. So we would underwrite the deal, you know, do our due diligence, and then I would start shopping the note. You know, if Alex liked deals, I'd call him up and say, hey, I've got this first lien position note on this deal. And we essentially would match you, right? We've got a borrower on one end of the transaction, and we've got a lender on the other. A lot of times that lender was using a self-directed account, which takes time to get money out of. It doesn't happen, you know, instantly. And so we were really challenged with that, right? Because, you know, on one end of the transaction, we got a borrower itching to close on this and dealing with a broker and sometimes a seller. And then I'm trying to coordinate with my lender, you know, to get their money and get them the information they need to make a decision if they want to fund it. And we also had a lot of clients that said, hey, I like the idea of notes and debt, but I don't want the risk. I don't want to deal with having to foreclose on Alex if he doesn't make his payments. You know, I need cash flow. And so, you know, I think what tends to happen is you have two different buckets of investors that are passively investing. You have some that want cash flow. Maybe they've retired. Maybe they've sold a business. And rather than depleting their nest egg, they want their money working for them. And they want to create multiple streams of income through these passive investments. And then I also had people that were just really growth minded that said, hey, I don't mind lending Alex 70 grand on that house that's worth 100. And if he doesn't pay, I'll take that thing back all day because instead of getting 10% on my money, I might have a potential $30,000 upside to this, right? And so I think that's where we evolved into creating these debt funds where we potentially can still work with our clients that want to fund the one-off deals and say, hey, I want to be the only guy in this deal because I'll foreclose and take it back. And then we could still accommodate our clients that said, I like debt. I like the idea of a first lien position note, but I don't want to be as hands-on as that. I don't want to hear from your servicing company that so-and-so didn't make their payments, and now I got to front $5,000 in foreclosure costs. The other thing with the debt funds is, too, you're diversified, right? So maybe you have 100 grand, and instead of buying one debt instrument at 100 grand, you're putting that 100 grand in the fund, and it's diversified over hundreds of debt components, you know? So you don't feel the pain as much if Alex isn't making his payments because you got 299 other deals in there that are paying. And so that's really where we evolved into managing these debt funds. The other big thing that is a real benefit, especially to people with self-directed IRA accounts and 401ks, is the fund provides the ability, and you talked about undeployed capital, the fund provides the ability for people to reinvest their earnings. So instead of their earnings getting paid out to their custodians and then it sits there till they find another deal or they have enough money, they can actually just reinvest their earnings every month. So they'll know exactly what they made. Now they're creating a compounding effect. So I think that debt directly is a great passive, you know, alternative investment, but it really just depends on the appetite of the investor. And I think a debt fund can also provide those same opportunities, but probably even better opportunities. But it all just kind of goes back to the investor, what they're trying to accomplish. Are they growth minded? Do they need cash flow? And how hands-on do they want to be? You know, there are a lot of clients that just don't want to deal with someone not paying. They would rather trust and invest in a fund where our departments and processes and procedures manage all of it, and they get the reports and they get their earnings and they never have any headaches of it. You know, where someone more risky.
And I think that's definitely, especially, you know, I don't like to kind of, you know, think that the only people listening are the self-directed investors, but especially, you know, the propensity for that to be available to people that are investing through retirement funds is very nice. You know, dealing with a retirement fund has its old kind of umbrella of things you have to deal with, since it's, you know, you're kind of dealing the retirement fund is like dealing as a third party. So, you know, beginning of my career, I did, you know, coming out of the recession and dealing with people doing foreclosures. You know, we dealt with a lot of foreclosures coming out of that once you could start getting them through the court system. Right. And yeah, dealing with a foreclosure with an IRA is, I mean, dealing with foreclosure any time of day is not nice, but especially with an IRA, when the IRA is named in a lawsuit and you're going through that, it's, again, nice to have a little bit of a buffer there. And, you know, I think people definitely see the benefit of doing these things. You know, again, loans are pretty hands-off, but even more hands-off than that. So getting into inherent structures, I know that you offer a Series A and a Reg D offering, correct? So you have a Reg A, non-accredited investor fund. Now, we'll get into the Reg D stuff in a minute, but I always find the Reg A stuff, especially in the realm of alternative assets, and I don't like that term for real estate or debt, because, I mean, heck, the Romans conquered real estate. You know, it wasn't, you know, alternative investment back then. And I don't know, last I checked, IBM wasn't around at the two millenniums ago. So, you know, from that perspective of, you know, kind of the democratization of alternative finance, how does that necessarily work? You know, it's easier to say like big chunks of money, accredited investors, you get access to all these deals. But when it comes to the Reg A stuff, I'm always very interested to know how people in the alternative asset space put these together. Because when you're dealing with, you know, significantly smaller chunks of capital from investors and a potential much larger pool of investors, structures tend to change. So I'm always interested when people have these types of offerings as to how you put them together and what the inherent benefit might be to choosing one versus the other.
Yeah, we had our accredited or our Reg D fund. That's been around almost 11 years. And one of the things that we were challenged with is we had so many clients come to us and say, I love the idea of putting money in a debt fund. I want to diversify my investment portfolio, but I'm not accredited. And so, as you probably know, the pool of accredited investors is much smaller than everybody else that doesn't qualify. And we always thought we were doing a disservice to people. You know, why should the potentially wealthy people be the only people that can invest in these kind of assets? Because we believe in them. We think there's power in them. We think there's better yields and you can get in a lot of traditional investments. And we didn't think it was fair or right to not be able to allow these unaccredited investors in. So They changed a lot of laws through the Jobs Act, and when they decided to open this up as an opportunity for operators like us, we jumped right on it. It's not an easy process to go to get approved for what's called a Reg A fund. It's quite daunting. It took over a year and was not cheap to open. But not only did we not have unaccredited investors, but a lot of our accredited investors have family and friends, senior parents, you know, that were trying to create cash flow, but didn't have an opportunity to do this. So that's why we did it. And it's a lot. Like you said, we have probably over 900 investors in our Regulation A unaccredited investor fund in comparison to about 250 in our accredited investor fund. But we also wanted a low barrier of entry. So our minimum investment into that fund is $1,000. Those two funds are managed the same. They're both debt funds. You know, we don't give one preference over the other, although there is a little bit different rate of return on the accredited fund versus the unaccredited because they're smaller dollars.
Gotcha. So how exactly do you structure these? Because I've talked with a few other people that run debt funds. And is it something where you're plugging in, acquiring private shares, and then the fund is managed? Or is it kind of you get to plug into on a little bit more micro level of picking, say, hey, I want to allocate to this loan. Then once it's fully funded on your books after you've originated it, then if it pays off, your capital comes back and you can redeploy. So let's talk a little about the mechanics of, you know, specifically how that works from the investor standpoint.
So our funds make money. We have multiple streams of income that come into our fund. And so what we do is we take 75% of the balance of the fund. So if we've got $1 million in there, we're going to take 750 grand and we lend that money out as debt. So the fund creates profit from the origination points, as well as the interest payments that are paid on a monthly basis. And what secures the asset is a first lien against that property in the fund's name. So they get shares into the fund. And then the other 25% of the fund balance, we actually invest those dollars into actual real estate properties in our local market. When those properties are bought and sold, that profit flows back into the fund. Every month we pay out all profit. So it's a little different than a syndication because these are short-term assets flowing in and out of there. And the big benefit is that we just pay out all the profit. They don't have to wait 3 to 5 years when we sell that property to make a profit on it. All profit on a monthly basis is sent out or reinvested, whichever the fund member decides that they want to do. So we simply manage the fund. We manage the fund. We report to them as the fund manager. I mean, a lot of us and employees are invested in these funds, but we don't have any ownership in it. All of the fund members own the entity that the fund is created under.
Okay, so just to make sure we got this clear, so the fund as a whole in the Reg A side, you purchase in as a, it's, what is this issue, as a private equity, a private share, a limited
it's
partnership?
LLC. Yeah, okay, we set it up as an LLC.
Okay, so private shares in an LLC, and then on a monthly basis, whatever is returned back into the fund, minus fees and operating costs, gets then returned. Is it returned as a pref return, or is it returned just as a distribution to the shareholders?
It's a pref return. Yeah.
Okay.
So their original capital stays in the fund until they want to exit the fund. They're just paid out their earnings.
And would that be paid out on K-1 for the investor?
It's paid out on a K-1. And the tie-up period in both of the funds is 12 months. So
okay,
they have to stay fully invested.
Sure. So from the tax perspective, because I always like to nerd out a little bit on taxes, because it's not how much you make, it's how much you keep, and the government's
right,
always trying to take every penny. So when you're receiving as an investor, and for those of you that aren't aware, essentially, if you're really new to this, typically when investing into a private fund, whether that's a syndication, as a limited partner, an LLC, a lot of different flavors, you're going to get a tax statement. You know, everyone gets tax statements, but it'll be called K-1, and it'll basically be a statement of how much you received out of that particular investment vehicle, and also what the the type of income that you're receiving. So it could be any number of things. I mean, it could be royalties from a movie, it could be oil and gas, leasing, whatever. But in this case, would it be, are the payments out, are they going to be paid as note income, or what exactly would be the determination of the pass-through on that?
There's a couple different profit buckets. So they do get paid out as interest earnings. You know, those
okay,
are the interest payments paid on the actual debt component. as well as real estate profits.
Okay.
And that can be from rents or as well as profits from the sale of the properties.
Okay. And with regard to the Reg A side, do you have any underlying debt that would pass through like in it, or is it all originated and then cash purchases of the real estate?
Yeah, we don't have the fund leveraged in that fund.
Okay, that's good. And for the people, and the reason I ask that question is especially for IRAs, if you're invested into a particular private entity that has underlying debt, for the retirement plan investors, that can pass through a potential taxable situation to you, which again is nice from the perspective of retirement plans investing, because you don't have any quirky tax returns to file for your IRA, which, you know, unless you're a glutton for punishment like me, can be a little bit onerous to kind of figure out how to file a 990T, which is the tax return that's used by tax exempt entities. Again, it gets into the weeds, but that's good to know from that perspective, is that there's no underlying debt to pass through. So that's basically just all gravy to the IRA, again, not just IRAs, but especially for retirement plan investors, have to be cognizant of that when that kind of stuff is paid through. Now, from the personal side, is there any type of depreciation or tax write-off that's also passed through to the investors?
There is a small amount of depreciation that's passed through, and that's just only on those assets that we hold as rental properties. Mm-hmm. They're not as many in that particular fund as the other fund, but those will always be passed through to the fund members.
Okay, great. And then how is it like broken up? Is it per share? Is it $1,000 shares that are offered of this? And then it's your earnings based on your actual basis in the fund. So if you invest, you know, 2000, your rate of return and your pref is based on your underlying investment amount.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. It's $1,000 a share in that one.
Okay, gotcha. So now we've kind of covered the Reg A side of things. Now let's maybe kind of compare and contrast on, you know, why someone might pick one versus the other. Let's say you are accredited. You know, the Reg A is great. If you're not accredited, it gives you access to, again, as corny as it sounds, I do democratization of private finance, I think is, you know, aptly named, because it lets you play at the same table as a lot of these people that were as the walled garden before. Yeah. But if you are an accredited investor, you know, you're probably many things, but, you know, probably pretty agnostic as to how you make money, so long as that one makes money and two is a good fit for your investment thesis. So if someone was accredited and looking at both, would there be a benefit, or what's the comparison between the two if you were trying to make a decision on, you know, what one offers that the other doesn't and vice versa?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. So the accredited investor fund, first of all, has a $50,000 buy-in. The other fund that is open to the general public, and I don't even like to call it an unaccredited investor fund. I just say you don't have to qualify to go into it, because there's plenty of accredited investors in that fund. That has a $1,000 minimum. So part of the answer to that question is sometimes it's dictated by how much money they have to deploy. I mean, I just put somebody that's an accredited investor into that fund because they didn't have $50,000. The other big difference is what is called the preferred or pref rate. The accredited investor fund does pay out a higher preferred rate. It's 9%. The other fund that's open to everybody pays out a preferred rate of 6%. So sometimes that is a determining factor for which fund that they go in. And then the last thing is the accredited investor fund pays earnings out quarterly. The other one pays out monthly. So again, I have accredited investors in that other fund because they like to have the earnings on a monthly basis versus the quarterly. So, you know, those three things typically determine which fund they go into if you're looking at an accredited investor. Obviously, if they are not qualifying, then they have to go into the other fund.
Sure. Now, from the perspective of lockups, would the lockups be the same between the Reg A and the Reg D funds?
They are. They're 12 months.
12 months. And then as far as, you know, liquidity of that, what would exactly be the exit procedure for someone on either of them? Because I know they vary widely from provider to provider.
Yeah. And that's a really good question to ask. I do a webinar from time to time on due diligence. And that's one of the things that I find that people don't ever ask. It's like, how do I get my money out? And that would be the first thing I would ask. But
yeah,
it's surprising. Ours is done over four quarters. And the reason for that is, as a fund operator, one of the biggest concerns that you have is what are we going to do if everybody comes to us tomorrow and says, hey, we want our money out? Because the reality is that money's not sitting in a bank account. That money's out there deployed in debt or in the acquisition of properties. And so when we set these up 11 years ago, me and the other two fund managers said, how do we manage this? And how do we manage people's expectations of when they can get their capital out? We don't want people to have to stay in if they aren't, you know, if it's not a good fit for them or they have an emergency, but we have to be able to manage it properly and so that the fund doesn't get what's called a run on the bank. And we have to go out and say, hey, sorry, none of you are getting your money right now. So it's done over 4 quarters. So you have to stay in for 12 months after your first investment. So people add dollars in as they go along. We don't start that over. It's from their first investment. And at that 12-month period, if they want to start to divest out of the fund or exit the fund, they're going to get 25% of what they're requesting out once a quarter, for every quarter for 4 quarters until they're fully divested out. And again, it's just a way for us to properly manage people divesting. You know, we know at the end of the quarter exactly how many dollars are coming out, and so that we can start to liquidate assets or set reserves aside so that we can always be able to exit people. We've never had to gate divestments or anything like that. And I'm pretty proud of that because it's not very common in this industry. It happens all the time.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Now, from the perspective of restrictions on these shares, are these restricted shares that people acquire? So let's say they wanted to liquidate or they wanted out of it. They couldn't sell it to another accredited investor. Or do you allow third party sales after the initial lockup?
We don't allow third party sales.
Okay. No. Yeah, it's, and these are especially for people coming in. If you're coming from the equities market side of things, and this probably doesn't ring as true for the accredited investors as much as the rank and file or the Reg A side, is that when you invest into something like this, there's not an open market. You know, when you go to hit sell at Fidelity on Microsoft, there are literally people called market makers that are out there with open orders to purchase something at a certain bid price. I won't get too far into that, but there's a market for you to actually sell this kind of stuff. And there is laws to enacted to make sure that there is open availability for things to be traded like that. When you get into something like this, even if you are someone who doesn't qualify for the accredited part, I always like to make sure people understand that while, yes, the underlying investment has to make sense for you, you know, doing this kind of stuff can be very beneficial. One, understanding what lockups are, and two, understanding that it's just a different way of doing things. You know, make sure you do your due diligence and understand that this is not the same thing as the stock market. And there's a lot of really good things that come from not doing things in the stock market, but they are different. You know, good, bad, or indifferent. Understanding what those differences are will make you better informed. And I think everyone can agree that the better informed investor is going to be better off. Whether you make a ton of money or not, you're always going to be better off being more informed than ignorant of anything in this arena.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more.
So from that perspective, or I should say, digging a little bit deeper, is there any difference in structure on how you do the accredited stuff? Is it still kind of a managed fund going out there, issuing debt, and then with a, you know, a certain floating point of direct real estate ownership within the fund, or is it fundamentally different in any way?
No, they're mirror images of each other in regards to that, the 75-25% split. We wanted multiple streams of income coming into our fund. You know, our concern is, you know, okay, great, we're only a debt fund. What happens if debt dries up, you know? And we're only an acquisition fund. What happens if the deals aren't there? And so we continue to do that 75-25% split because it does provide the fund with multiple streams of income. And if I know that my origination team and my loan officers don't have a healthy pipeline, I could potentially ramp up acquisitions as well as vice versa. If I don't see that my acquisition team has enough deals in their pipeline, you know, if there's an extra deal that we could fund to keep the money out there deployed, we could potentially do that
as well. Now, as far as the real estate portion of that, is it, what's the investment thesis for the investment for the real estate portion? Is it rental property? Is it just straight buy, sell, buy, hold? What's kind of the main modus that you run with that?
Well, I think that's evolved over the years. I think as a real estate investor, you have to be able to pivot your strategies.
Yeah.
But one of the things that we stay true to is the asset class. And what we lend against is the same types of assets that we buy. So single family up to four units. That's what we're buying. As the market has shifted over the last 12 months, we have started to hold more as rentals because there's been a great opportunity for that in our market. Rents have increased. And so we're always looking to pivot. But historically, we've done quite a bit of fix and flip. You know, we buy a lot of off-market deals, distressed sellers, out-of-town homeowners. We used to go to foreclosure auction often. That's not been as lucrative as it was. But we're, you know, we're looking for those off-market deals where we can get in, do minimal rehab, regardless of whether we're going to exit by selling or exit by renting, and then get them back on the market and get in, get them cash flowing from the funds.
Yeah, it definitely makes sense. And I think that kind of leads me into the last question I kind of want to cover is, you know, we've seen a lot of, I don't know the best word for it, we've seen a lot of interesting things when it comes to money in general and lending and all sorts of stuff over the past 12 months, whether it be the Fed just, you know, kind of driving off a cliff with raising interest rates, whether it's, you know, pullbacks in the real estate markets. You know, where do you see this kind of market going in the next few years, and how does that, you know, kind of, you know, play into your investment philosophy? Obviously, this is incredibly fluid. You know, we don't know what's going to happen 1 month away as much as we don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. But, you know, kind of what are some of the trends that you're seeing that investors should watch out for? And how does that, you know, affect your strategy in the long run?
Yeah, I mean, we're still seeing a lot of opportunity in the marketplace, you know, from a buy perspective. You know, I think that the amount of properties out there available to buy are much less, you know, because again, you have people that probably typically would have upgraded from 3 to 5 years ago, right? They're not willing to leave that mortgage. It's at 3% and sometimes even lower. So those people aren't selling. But like we tell our staff too, it's a great time to buy because you're buying a house right now for probably $100,000 less than you would have bought it 12 months ago. I mean, we watch these markets and we're just seeing prices slash. So I think if you're positioned well as an investor, whether you're a big fund like us or an individual, and you have a good cash position, there are opportunities out there. Now, even though there's opportunities, you're probably not going to be able to sell them as quickly as you are, you know, you would have. So what does that exit look like? Are you going to cash flow them and rent them? You know, one of the things we've told some of our employees, even if you have a house right now that you're currently living in and you have 3% mortgage on it, go rent that. Then it cash flows. It's probably not going to cash flow at 8%, 7.5%. So, you know, back to your question, we still see opportunity in the market, but we are proceeding with caution. Especially in certain markets that are distressed and they're not selling properties, you know, we're kind of pulling back from lending in those areas or maybe just not lending as much. But, you know, I think if you're a savvy investor and you have a great cash position, I still think the market's good. We don't think interest rates are coming down anytime soon. We think maybe quarter two, quarter three, we'll start to see them come down, but they probably will come down, not back to, you know, crazy 2-3% money, but, you know, maybe 5 or 6.
Yeah.
But we also, you know, are concerned. I mean, we are just about, if not in a recession, and I think it is going to get worse before it gets better. You know, and again, we are proceeding with caution. We are still investing. Know your numbers. You know, either the deal makes sense and the numbers are there, or you just move on to the next one. Don't do deals just to get your money out there deployed. That's one of the things I hear so much about. And the other thing I would tell people to be weary of is don't chase rate. If you have a deal presented to you and it seems too good to be true, it probably is. You know, align yourself with someone as far as an operator goes that has a track record, that has went through 2008 and COVID, you know, and ask them, how did you guys weather the storm? You know,
and that's one thing I brought up in a podcast the other day is that, you know, it bears repeating, and it's something that I really feel like people need to focus on is that, you know, if you're looking at someone to deploy your capital with, or you're investing with certain people, even if it's on a more like individual basis, not with like a fund like you or just, you know, like me and someone else doing a deal, you could look like an absolute like financial genius if you invested in real estate over the past 10 years with zero going on between your ears. I mean, it's been up and to the right. You know, and that's nothing, it's not something to shake, you know, a stick at, to have someone say, yeah, I've had a decade of experience. Well, you really haven't had a market that allowed you to really lose a whole lot. And if you did, then you really had to do something bad to really have lost money in real estate. So it just, you know, what I would say to people, you know, from what I've seen, and granted, I'm one of those people, I've seen, you know, not that we sell investments, but, you know, I started my career in 2011 in this arena. And, you know, I've kind of seen it firsthand is that, you know, people just really haven't lost. They haven't gone through anything really cataclysmic like 2008. Granted, COVID was rocky, but, you know, it didn't really shake all the cobwebs out. You know, if you could survive 4 months from, you know, March of 2020 to, you know, October, most people were fine. You know, people started buying houses and going gangbusters with it, you know, with those low interest rates. And to your point of chasing interest rates too, you know, it is not realistic for an economy on monetary policy to run at 2% on an open market. You know, a realistic interest rate, who's to say what that is, but, you know, 13% like we saw in the 80s, probably not. But, you know, 5% on a mortgage, that's pretty good. You know, it's, you know, 8%'s, you know, dicey, but it's not unreasonable. And you just have to kind of understand that. I think people just need to be very realistic about the direction the market's going. You know, don't be scared about it. Be realistic. You know, you shouldn't shelter away from it, but also understand, you know, just double down on understanding what deals are good, making sure you talk to people that if they, you know, haven't gone through a big thing like 2008, you know, that are realistic in their expectations of things and say, hey, yeah, I understand this, you know, this boat doesn't continue to go in one direction. It's going to have to anchor for a while. So yeah, again, I really do appreciate your insights in looking at everything today. It's always interesting when I get to talk about something I really enjoy for my clients and as an investment as a whole, which is debt, you know, many different benefits to it. So again, I do really appreciate you being on with us today, Heather. Anything that you'd like to leave people with, especially contact information, if they want to get in touch with you to learn more about investing or any final thoughts, now's the time.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, they can always visit our website. That's going to be at securedinvestmentcorp.com, securedinvestmentcorp.com, or they can call the number 800-971-5988. We're a pretty small team as far as our investor relations team. I take calls and, you know, I guess the last words I would want to leave people with is as you are doing your due diligence and looking at these alternative investments out there, ask these operators the hard questions. And it's okay. I mean, this is your hard-earned capital and you should ask them questions. And if they're not willing to give you answers, that might be a red flag for you. You know, look for operators that are transparent, have open lines of communication. I hear horror stories of people, oh, I made this investment and now nobody will call me back. You know, if you can't call them and directly get a hold of them and someone's calling you back that day, that's probably a sign that's not a good fit for you. Look for operators that audit their funds by an outside auditing firm. We use a third-party auditing firm. It's not to say that people are required to do that, and it's not to say that there aren't good operators out there that internally do it, but the odds are when someone's internally auditing funds and bank accounts, there's a lot more room for error, and I hear also horror stories because of that. But yeah, take responsibility for your money. If you're going to start investing, you know, outside of your traditional sources and outside of a financial advisor, which I promote, I think it's good. But you have to take some ownership in that. And I tell people, do your own push-ups, ask the questions. And there's never a reason that there's too many questions. If anybody says that, like I said, that's not a good fit for you. People should be transparent and you should be concerned, you know, this is your money. So you have to have some responsibility.
Absolutely. Well, Heather, again, I really do appreciate you being on with us today. I know everyone's most valuable asset is their time. So thank you for spending some of it with us. Again, this has been the Alternative Investment Advantage Podcast. My name is Alex Perney, and everyone, I hope you have a great day.
Thank you for tuning in to the Alternative Investing Advantage Podcast. Tune in next week for more investing tips and strategies.
Want to hear more episodes of the Alternative Investing Advantage? Search podcast at advantaira.com and subscribe.